So we'll see how far we get as far as the practicalities. But what we'd like to do is at least speak in general terms about what we could try to understand in terms of the prohibition of ribis, of interest, which is one of the more complex areas of Jewish law in many different senses of the word. The Torah talks about a prohibition of taking interest in at least three places. You find it in Parshas Mishpatim, you find it in Parshas Behar, and you find it in Sefer Devarim. At least three places the Torah talks about phrases, which the word ribis really appears in the Talmud. We don't find that word in the Torah as much or at all. We talk about neshech or tarbis, which are two different terms which perhaps speak to two different themes. Tarbis means an increase. And the word ribis is some type of a construct of that. And neshech means to bite. And that kind of already alerts us to two different themes within the prohibition of taking interest, which is given in one form in the Torah. And then in the Talmud we find that it's extensively added upon and built on top of, that there are many, many extensions, which is itself striking, itself something to consider, the fact that ribis is such a growth industry, so to speak, in a different sense of the word, that Chazal felt the need to build so many fences around this prohibition. What exactly did that say about things? So this Talmud has one basic principle which addresses the whole concept. The Talmud says, Klola de Rabisa, that the basic principle of ribis is kol agar natale, that we prohibit any reward, agar is in the phrase, b'fumsar agra, kol agar natar, for anything, that any reward that you get for waiting. So in general, when you get interest for money, so you're not really providing a service, what you're doing is you're providing your willingness to wait. Then instead of taking my money today, or instead of holding on to my money today, I will give you my money and I'll wait for it for a month, a year, 2 years, 10 years, whatever it is. Or in some cases, it's that you owe me money and I'll wait longer for getting it back. Whatever it is, it basically boils down to the payment of time, payment for time, and which the Talmud calls waiting in this context. So to get paid for waiting is, waiting is also a different usage than time, because when we say getting paid for time, sometimes, you know, we talk like a lawyer gets paid for providing his time, and we measure his service based on his time. So that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about you're not providing a service during that time. You are providing your willingness to wait, your willingness to let time pass before you get back your money. So the Talmud calls that called agar natale, and that's the basic principle for what we prohibit when it comes to taking interest.
What about opportunity cost?
So opportunity cost is sometimes the reason why we want to charge interest, which is relevant. How much of a difference it makes, we have to figure out, because it may still translate to agar natale. It may still translate into waiting for time, waiting many for waiting, but even though the motivation might be, I might call it an opportunity cost, I could have used this money for something else. So I have to see how that factors into things.
Well, what about it from the other side?
Mm-hmm.
I provided you with the opportunity to use my asset.
Mm-hmm.
For which you should pay nothing? You should pay someday? What?
It could be that you should pay nothing. That's something we have to figure out. So what exactly is the nature of this prohibition? So what we'll find here is that categorizing this prohibition is very challenging. And again, we'll see how much we can say about it today. We might have to carry this over a little bit. We'll see how much we can say about it today. Categorizing the prohibition is very challenging because there are many different theories as to what is so terrible, what is so bad about taking interest. And this is a prohibition which exists in other religions as well. Islam has a prohibition against taking any kind of interest, and in Christianity you find this as well. And sometimes it's influenced by the Torah text, and sometimes it comes from elsewhere. And we have a word in the English language, usury. So usury had meant different things in different settings and in different generations. The way it's used today, we'll discuss what that means in a second, it's probably not an appropriate translation for ribis. The way usury is used today is often synonymous with the term predatory lending. And essentially, you are taking advantage of somebody's moment of financial weakness, and saying, okay, you need me to be able to do what you have to do to survive. So therefore, I can take advantage of the fact that you essentially can't say no to whatever terms I'm going to offer. So I will force you to agree to a high rate of interest. And, you know, we could certainly paint the picture where the morality is very much wanting. I could paint the picture of a widow with 12 children who needs to pay the rent, and I'll say to her that, sure, I'll give you money for this month's rent if you pay me 100% interest a month later. And then when she doesn't have that money a month later, so then I'll say, oh, it's backing up, you know, and I'll bring in my enforcers. We could certainly paint the picture where it gets worse and worse. Right, but loan sharking is essentially also sometimes synonymous with usury. It depends on how it's enforced, but it's also a related term. So usury, in earlier settings, sometimes is identical with interest, and in the modern usage, it's more used to mean predatory lending of this type. So if that will...
Excessive
interest, right. So excessive being a function of predatory, that I going more than what would be expected for the normal... Right, so I think it's a component of it, that because I'm preying on this person, so I am also taking more than I should take under those circumstances. So...
But that's not our...
That seems not to be our ribbis, right. Now, correct. So that's why I'm saying it's probably not a good model for ribbis. Doesn't mean that ribbis is absent of that. The fact that the Torah uses, at least in one setting, the word neshef, and the fact that the Gemara does build on that phrase, the Sefer HaChinuch has a formulation which builds on that phrase, that takes a bite out of you and keeps biting and biting until you have nothing left. So there is an aspect of that. You know, certainly that picture that we painted with the elderly widow, we certainly would have a huge problem with that in and of itself. You know, that we certainly are sensitive to the issue of predatory interest. It happens to be that it seems that that's not all we're worried about. That even where that's clearly not an element, where it's much more consistent with standard business practices, so we still have a problem with interest.
Again, I'm coming in, but why does it only apply to Jews?
So that's part of the question. So if we're talking about predatory interest, so then you probably argue that's a basic Adam L'Chaver, it probably should apply to anybody. But when we talk about the prohibition of ribbis, as we're going to see, and I'll discuss your question more pointedly in a minute, so you'll find that we have such a extensive broadening of this concept that we're clearly talking about something else. That when we look at the prohibition of ribbis, so if we want to say that we understand that you're taking advantage of the person, so we have a lot of questions. There are so many issues here that deviate from that model that really challenges us to figure out how we should categorize this concept. So we say ribbis is complex, so we mean it in at least two senses of the word. It's complex in that the details are exceedingly complex and way beyond the scope of one discussion, but also the concept, to understand what exactly we're talking about, how should we categorize this concept, is very complex. So if we wanted to say that it just meant I'm taking advantage of somebody and I'm hurting them because I'm taking away more from them than I should, so we're left with a lot of questions. First of all, that we find that the prohibition applies to any rate of interest. It's not that there's a certain threshold where it's permissible. It's prohibited across the board. And even if we say this is a standard practice, even if we say that I could be, touch a little bit on your opportunity cost issue, even if I say that I could be making this much if I left it in the bank, so why should I make less than that? All of the very reasonable formulations that you would have for ribbis tend to not help. It tends to be prohibited at any number. That's A. That's very difficult point, number one. In addition, if we're talking about a predator and a victim here, so then it's surprising that we find that the Talmud tells us clearly that the quote-unquote victim is equally guilty. That's an unthinkable model in any other type of a situation. And if I put a gun to your head and I say, give me your money, so it seems I committed a crime, and it would seem quite clear that you're a victim. So to say here, we're both equally guilty, and we don't mean in the usual blame the victim sense, we mean that you both participated equally in a transgression, so that also is a major deviation from an interpersonal model that we would normally have. And to take that example one step further, so if I put a gun to your head and say, give me your money, that's called theft. That's called holding you up. What happens if we tweak the model a little bit so that there's no gun, and in fact, you offer me the money, and you say, here's $100, I'd love for you to have it. So I think we'd all agree that that removes all the elements of the crime. It's not called a crime anymore. The victim willingly gives up the money, not only willingly, but of his own initiative, so then there's no crime there. But when we transfer this to Ribbis, that's not the case at all. And that even if the Lova, the borrower, is more than willing and is suggesting it on his own and is insisting, none of that helps. It's still, just as much a prohibition for both of us. And all of this deviates from the model of interpersonal transgressions that we normally have. And one other deviation is that we find that the Torah is explicitly telling us that this is a Jewish concept, that this is a prohibition relating to Jews, and that when it comes to non-Jews, the Torah tells us explicitly that the prohibition doesn't exist. So if this was really an issue of morality, if there's really something fundamentally unfair or immoral about taking this money, then it should apply to everybody. So why do we find this explicit exception in the Torah? Also, yet again, one other reason to question if it really follows a model of predatory type of behavior.
What's the image as the lowest, you know, like in Shakespeare,
right, Merchant of Venice, because there especially
we get the image of being a terrible, you know.
Right, so that was part of it, because
so it can't be that we're doing something that. Well, part, it gives us a terrible image.
Right, and part of the idea there was because the Christians wouldn't let the Jews do anything else, and also wouldn't let themselves, because they've also adopted this principle, so it was a perfect storm of problems. If you're interested in the halachas of the Merchant of Venice, from a different issue, Rav Zevin in the Sefer Lor Halacha has a fascinating essay about the Merchant of Venice, which isn't even about interest at all. Is it about other elements within the Merchant of Venice that one could talk about? So we're going to have a future share about the Merchant of Venice, separate from issues of interest is what to talk about. But in any event, so all of this really pushes this whole category, this whole halacha, out of the category of an adam l'chavero, and then the icing on the cake. So there are those who maintain that this is really not a monetary concept. It uses money, and it seems to be very much in the realm of an adam l'chavero, of interpersonal rules. But maybe it's not. Maybe it should be categorized with ritual concepts such as kashrus and nida and chatness and
like
the like.
Like a chok.
It should be a right. Or a chok, or it should be not perceived in the monetary category of choshen mishpat, of monetary laws, of civil law, but rather it should be categorized with ritual law. And the biggest statement to that direction is the fact that the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch following him, where do they codify the laws of Ribbis? In Yoredei. Right, which is a very powerful statement, that you don't find this in Choshen Mishpat, it's not in the civil code, it's not in that section of the code of Jewish law that talks about civil law and monetary law, it's in Yoredei. It's there together with kosher laws, with everything else that is of a ritual nature. So that's a very powerful statement, that we're talking about something very different. So on the other hand, there were those who did feel it was a monetary law, and if that's the case, then we have to understand why it has these deviations. So, just to try to clarify that on a conceptual level, I think you could basically formulate, let's say, at least two, probably more, at least two theories as to what is driving this prohibition. Now, on the one hand, if we want to maintain that it is an interpersonal concept, that it does involve taking advantage of somebody or something like that, so then we still have a lot of questions, and we have to understand why is it only a Jewish concept, etc., etc. So one could suggest, even within the model of an interpersonal concept, that what we're talking about is that, yes, if I'm going to take advantage of the poor widow and prey on her and exploit the person who is has no other options, so then that is a moral principle that would apply to everybody, no question. If we're talking about a more reasonable rate of interest, which we find the prohibition applying to as well. So what we're saying is that as far as decency and humanity and morality, there's nothing wrong with a basic rate of interest. There were Christian philosophers who thought there was something wrong with that. There's a whole discussion in the earlier literature about why the Torah seems to be prohibiting interest, if you take it that way. And there were those who felt that there were conceptual problems with charging for time, charging for something you don't provide a service. There were theories that Christian philosophers had. We could say that what we're talking about here is that when it comes to the family, so to speak, when it comes to the Jewish nation. So we're told that even that which is reasonable business practice is not for family. That, yes, it's legitimate to charge some rate of return for the usage of your money. That is accepted practice in the business world. But you don't do that to your brother. You know, you do that to others. And therefore, and not that there's anything wrong with it, it's just that the family relationship requires a higher standard of closeness. So therefore, and this is the Ramban in his commentary to Chumash, basically makes this point. And therefore, the prohibition of ribbis, according to this, is to enhance the family relationship, so that there should be a higher standard of closeness among the Jewish people. So if that's the case, that's the way the Ramban seems to understand it. So, for example, one of the great poskim, one of the great decisors in the laws of ribbis, was the Sacht Shavar Rebbe, who wrote the Seilas and Shuvas Avnei Nezer of Ram Bornstein, very important to work of his sponsor. So in his Shuvas, he has a whole separate section on the laws of ribbis, and he gave it its own title. The title that he gave to the separate section is called Bris Achim. Bris Achim has two things going for it. On the one hand, the word Bris is an anagram of the word ribbis. He took the word letters and flipped them around. But also, he's trying to say that the theme of ribbis is that there should be a special covenant among brothers, that there should be this special family relationship, that we should see each other as brothers, and therefore, perhaps that's the underlying theme of the contract.
Okay. Based on that, if you say that the money is really not ours,
mm-hmm.
it's Hashem's,
mm-hmm.
and he was just lending it to us, or just giving whatever it is, it's really not our money, because it's not,
mm-hmm.
and how it's distributed is irrelevant, meaning and we can't charge interest because it's not our money.
That could be one of the theory. You're adding another element to the theory. So,
or you're saying it's part of the family, but it's Hashem's money. It's God's money. So it's not mine to charge interest on.
That could be. The problem is, and then you get into all kinds of other problems, and you shouldn't be able to sell anything. You shouldn't be able to charge for anything.
I understand. I'm dealing with interest. I understand.
Right. This is
okay. I understand.
I hear.
Right? God had me, sir, ma'am, I have extra money. Right? I have this money, okay? It's his money. So he's allowed to say, don't charge interest. That's the point.
Extra.
The amount of money I get is not determined by me. So how much money we have, how much wealth we have, is determined by God, correct?
Right.
Right? And if someone needs the money, if someone else needs money, he can decide how to disperse it, distribute it. So if someone needs money, it's his money, and if I can give it to him, but I shouldn't ask him to pay extra because it's not my money. He's sort of lending it to me or giving to me.
We can go into your closet and take your clothes.
No, we're talking money. Again, possession is, I understand, but there's a certain ownership, but again, I'm talking with money.
Well, the question why you would draw the line then if that theory is the controlling theory, which is what they're just getting at. So there's work to try to figure out if that works, but I hear where you're coming from. So if you follow that type of approach, so essentially what you're saying is that really this is close to this, but in a sense this is an interpersonal concept, but it's not just standard interpersonal concept, which is usually basic morality and applies to all of humanity. This is not basic morality. This is enhanced. This is enhanced family relationships, which would subject to a different standard. However, we're still left with all these challenges that basically seem to see it not as any type of a interpersonal issue, but seems to see it more as a Yoredeya kind of concept. So how do you address that? So we could perhaps suggest a different theory. Maybe we could say as follows. There is an interesting parallel one could draw, that in Parshas Behar, one of the three places where you find the concept of ribbis coming up, so it's mentioned there together with Shemitah. Which doesn't seem to have any connection at all. Shemitah, every 7 years, the Torah tells us to leave our land open and to not work it, leave it available for everyone. So one could perhaps note a connection between these two concepts. And when it comes to Shemitah, so here the Torah tells me I can't work my land for this year. And especially in the language of the rabbis, so you find a strong relationship between all of the agricultural commandments, but specifically Shemitah, and the concept of emunah, of faith. So what's the connection specifically to faith? So we understand what the connection is, right? That for you to go a year without working your land and to hope you'll survive, that takes a lot of faith. To believe that I can make it through this year without working my land, it's not something the average person has such an easy time with. So, okay, so it's an expression of faith to adhere to the laws of Shemitah. So what would you say in the following scenario? What would you say if somebody would say, listen, Rabbi, I'm willing to follow the laws of Shemitah. I'm willing to let my land go for a year and not work it. On one condition. I want the rabbis to sign me a contract. They should write a contract and they should say that if it turns out after this year that I lost any money, that I'm behind it all, that you will pay me back for any loss that I have, that you will indemnify me against any loss that I have for observing this rule. Now, technically speaking, this person might still be in fulfillment of the commandment of Shemitah, and maybe a very generous rabbi might decide to do this if he was so concerned, but it's hard to believe that that's such an impressive show of faith, that it might technically fit the rules, but you're clearly losing the whole faith element there if you're saying that I'm only going to do this if you will guarantee me that I will be covered for any loss. So then that's maybe right. That's lacking as far as faith is concerned. So one could say, when it comes to Ribbis as well, that the parallel is related to that. The Torah tells us clearly that there is an obligation to provide loans to people who need it. Which doesn't mean that you have to just throw your money away to people who aren't going to return it, and there are all kinds of circumstances we'll assume are in evidence.
There is an obligation to provide loans?
There is an obligation to provide loans, which again, you have to figure out the parameters of that obligation and the parameters of how much you can expect in terms of... Right, how much you can expect in terms of making sure you get it back. You're not obligated to throw your money away. You're assuming that it's going to be returned to you, and assuming you can afford it, assuming that a number of elements are at play. But this is considered to be actually one of the primary examples of the concept of chesed. So we have this mandate that we talked about a little bit in the past weeks. It's actually interesting. Originally, we were going to talk about this, we ended up not talking about this, we talked about Pikar Cholam and things like that. So it's all the same family. Yeah, we have an obligation, it's all the same category, that we have an obligation to help people out. And this is actually different than stucco for the most part. If a person never pays you back, it turns into stucco. And you have to figure out if you can afford that much stucco. And you have to, it's also part of the decision that you make. But assuming the person pays you back, so this is considered to be an act of chesed. Chesed is distinct from stucco. Stucco means you give somebody material goods. And chesed means you help them out in other ways. So to provide a loan to somebody is considered to be an example of that kind of chesed that we're commanded, that kind of kindness that we're commanded to engage in. It's actually interesting. People don't realize how much of the discussion of chesed is about this. There's a contemporary sefer called Mitzvah Shal Chesed, which you would think is about the theme of chesed. It's all about loaning money. And one of the classical works on the laws of chesed is this Chofetz Chaim. Say the Chofetz Chaim had written a classical work on the laws of speech. So he also wrote a work on chesed called Ahavas Chesed, the love of chesed. Probably half the sefer is about loans. And also to the point, so we use the word gemach nowadays, which is an acronym for gemilas chesedim. So what is that for? That is for a loan service. A person sets up the gemach either means they lend out objects that are useful in whatever context, or often it means they lend out money. So chesed, perhaps to a greater degree that we realize, is identified with lending out money. And there are all kinds of other mitzvahs also connected to loaning out money. The Torah also tells us that if you see somebody who is about to collapse financially, you see that somebody is at a turning point where if he can't afford the next step, he's really going to descend, he's really going to lose his financial standing. So then the Torah gives us a specific mitzvah in that context to uphold somebody who's about to fall in that sense. And we find many other mitzvahs. We could list five or six different mitzvahs probably, depending on the circumstances, where you find the Torah telling us that when it's possible to help somebody out with a loan and you're confident that you'll be able to get it back, or you have every right to take a mashkon, to take a collateral. In fact, there are those who understand that taking a collateral is actually an independent mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to take a collateral. So why that should be, it seems to be something you do for your own security. So there's a whole discussion of that concept for a different time, but maybe because it makes you more confident to get it back, or because it gives the borrower more status as somebody who knows it's being taken seriously. whatever it is very possibly a special mitzvah to take collateral when it's relevant, which is an interesting topic. But all of that just comes to emphasize that there is this mitzvah of loaning when possible. So, again, for a person to say, I'm afraid of not getting my money back, that's reasonable. But for a person to say, let's say a person says, listen, God, you tell me you want me to lend money, you want me to help out people? Fine, I'll do it. I'll do it on one condition. I want to be indemnified from the beginning that I will make as much on this loan as I would in the bank. Not, you know, some fancy, you know, the lowest level, whatever it is. But I want to be guaranteed that this chesed will pay me back as much as the bank. That is an offense against God. That is not an offense against the person you're loaning to. The person you're loaning to might be perfectly happy, might be more than happy, might be dying to do this arrangement, but that's not what God wants. So that becomes, apparently, maybe that's a theory, that that's an avera ben adam l'makom. That is a transgression, not between man and man, between man and God. God told me this is what I have to do. And for me to say, okay, I'm only going to do it if you guarantee me I'll get the same return as when I put it in the bank. And again, just to clarify, so this point shouldn't get lost, there's nothing wrong with saying I want to be guaranteed I'm not going to lose my principal. To say I want a contract, I want a collateral, I want there to be a security that I'm not going to lose the money I'm laying out here, that's understandable. But to say that I want this act to be as profitable for me as putting it in the bank or investing it somewhere, and maybe it will be, because we believe it's a Shkar Mitzvah, but I want it in a contract with this person, so then that becomes a problem, not between man and man, but between man and God. And if that's the case, if that's the theory, it could explain a couple of things. First of all, the Gemara has some statements that whoever engages in interest is like denying God, or is like denying Yetzias Mitzrayim, which the Rambam codifies as well. So what did that guy do with anything? You know, we have all kinds of other prohibitions of hurting people. And we say, we understand the concept, whoever hurts somebody this way, it's like I hurt somebody that way. To compare it to heresy. You know, what did the guy do with heresy? What did the guy do with denying God's grace and benevolence? Things like that. What did the guy do with anything? So maybe if this is a theory, that maybe it's not about what you're doing to this person. What you're doing to this person is reasonable. But what it's about is denying this setup that God has, that you should act the chesed and it'll be okay for you. So this could also explain another, thank you, this could also explain another somewhat anomalous point in the laws of Ribbis, that we mentioned before that there is a basic Torah prohibition of Ribbis, and then there is extensive rabbinic legislation on top of that. And as we'll discuss, we'll probably have to have a part two, because I don't think we'll get all this in today, but it's striking that there's so much drabbanim, there's so much rabbinical legislation on top of this, but it's also striking how little of it then boils down to the Torah prohibition sometimes. So to look at the Torah model, what is it that the Torah by itself prohibits before the rabbis made the extra prohibition? So Ribbis is only prohibited from the Torah if it's what we call ribbis ktsutza, which means that it has to be set at the initial time of the loan. But I have to say, I'm going to lend you this money, I'm giving you $100, and you have to pay me back $125. And that's the deal. If I lend you $100, plain. And then a month later, you're ready to pay me back, I say, well, listen, I think it should be $125 because you owe me for the loan, but it wasn't agreed from beforehand. So that is prohibited, but strikingly, it's not the biblical prohibition of ribbis. If it's predatory, then it has other issues, but if it's normal, but it wasn't set at the beginning, so then it already is not the biblical prohibition of ribbis. That already is a rabbinical concept. So that's very striking. Why should that be? Now, if we're talking about there's something wrong with taking the money that is interest, so then the taking should be our interest. It should be, no pun intended, the taking should be our focus, that I shouldn't be able to take it. So any format in which it's being paid to me, that should be the problem. I said it before, I said it later, I didn't say it, he suggested it, what difference does it make? So the idea that it's really the deal that's the problem is very striking. That what is the Torah really upset about? That we made this deal. The deal has reality from the fact that I collect the rivers later, and we'll see, I guess probably in part two, what kind of a difference that makes. But the deal is the real offense. To set up this deal, that's the real problem. So why should that be? It doesn't seem to make any sense.
Is it like a societal thing? If you do it afterwards,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have that thing. If everybody does it at the beginning, then it's going to create society that doesn't let that come into the
mental. So that's right. So if you want to take the Bris Achim view, the more interpersonal view, so maybe that's also part of it. That maybe the saying that I'm already not treating you like family from the very beginning, it's a higher level of problem. But also within what we're saying here, I think it makes even more sense. You know, that the idea is it's not that I took interest from you. It's that I said I'm only going to lend you money if I have this guarantee. And that's an offense against God. That's an Avera Ben Adam L'Makom. To say, I'm only going to lend you money under these circumstances, that's what bothers us. And the fact that you took money later, that's a reflection of that deal, but it's not our great focus. If you took exploitative money again, that's a whole different problem. But taking the money itself is not necessarily the issue, or the primary issue, depending on what it is. Okay, so we only have a few more minutes, so is next week good to continue part two? So we'll continue with part two. I'll just, in the 5 minutes that we have, I'll just mention another issue that comes out of this, and there are other issues that also directly flow from what we're saying, so we'll have to keep in mind what we're saying. We'll review a little bit. Is that another issue, that there is a commandment in the Torah, that the Gemara understands that there's an obligation, also a separate mitzvah, to return the ribbis. If you have collected ribbis, you have to pay it back. So on the one hand, that is a mitzvah on the...
Without interest, right.
That would definitely complicate things. You pay back the interest that you collected has to be returned without interest. So the issue there, first of all, that's taken as a separate mitzvah. And on top of that, there is a machlokus from the Gemara, whether or not the court, whether or not Beis Din will get involved. Do we assume that not only are you obligated to return it, but Beis Din will enforce returning it, just like Beis Din can enforce any other monetary issue. If I steal money from you, so Beis Din will enforce that I should pay back the money. If I damage your property, Beis Din will enforce that there's a debt there, etc., etc. So it is a dispute in the Gemara, and we happen to rule that they do, that Beis Din does get involved and will enforce this repayment. So there's both a mitzvah on the lender to give it back, and there is a concept that the Beis Din will get involved, we call Yotzei B'Dayanim, that it comes out through the enforcement of the Dayanim of the judges. And we actually assume this is one of the many, many differences between biblical ribbis and the Rabbanan Dikar ribbis, that there is this concept of Yotzei B'Dayanim only applies to Ribbis D'Oraisa. That is only the biblically prohibited, what we call again, Ribbis Ketzutza, the set interest from the very beginning, that's what has this concept of Yotzei B'Dayanim, that the judges will get involved and enforce the thing returned, and it doesn't necessarily apply if we're talking about only rabbinically prohibited interest. So this mitzvah to give back ribbis, so it's an analytical question, which maybe we can expand on a little bit next week. Is that its own concept? Is that a reflection of the fact that it was prohibited in the first place, so therefore you can't keep it? Are we saying essentially this is stolen money? You have no right to it. So therefore, if I steal money, you have to give it back. So this is a simple extension of that. So, for example, the Rambam, Maimonides, when he tried to list the mitzvos, right? The whole approach, which was only undertaken at a certain narrow point in history, at the 400-year period in history, that the scholars got involved in this approach. The Talmud tells us that there are 613 mitzvos. It's become a very significant Jewish number because of that. So we assume there are 613 commandments in the Torah. So there's no list of them, let's say, before around 800. And around that time, so some of the Rishonim got involved in this job of trying to list what the mitzvahs are. And it was a controversial topic. not clear what difference it makes. A couple of books written about this issue, trying to figure out, does it make a difference whether we call something a mitzvah or not? Two mitzvahs, three mitzvahs, one mitzvah, no mitzvahs, does it matter? It's just a question of law. Does it matter how we categorize it? Not clear. So it was about a 400-year period in our history where scholars got involved in making the list. After that, nobody makes new lists. They just talk about the old lists. Before that, there were no earlier lists. So this is about the year 800 to about, let's say, 900 to 1300. Around then, that you find the Rambam and the Sajigon and the Smag and the Smag, they all tried to come up with lists of what the mitzvahs were. So the Rambam, in his list of mitzvahs, he does not list the mitzvah to give back with us. Seems to be clearly a mitzvah in the Torah, or a din in the Torah to give back the rivers. And the Ramban has his glosses, Nachmanides has his glosses on the Rambam, which he calls the mitzvah that the Rambam forgot. This is a funny title, because presumably the Rambam didn't forget, he just didn't think they were mitzvahs, but that's the way the Ramban categorized them. And among them, he says, the mitzvah of paying back rivers, but the Rambam doesn't list it. So some of the commentaries understand that the Rambam didn't list it because he thinks it comes automatically, that essentially this is like money that's illegitimately in your hands. So it's like stolen money. If you already have a mitzvah, you have to, there is a separate mitzvah to pay back stolen money. So maybe you don't need a separate mitzvah for ribbis. Maybe it's the same concept. And others maybe feel that, no, there is something fundamentally different here. And Shaul Zev Gustman, who was a very distinguished Rosh Yeshiva of Netzach Yisrael, wrote very important works on the Talmud. So he has a collection of essays. The Gemara above Matiah is the fifth parak above Matiah that lays down all the rules of Ribbis, parak Ezel Nasha. So in his essays over there, so he suggests that we could see this three ways. We could see that essentially it becomes like a monetary issue, that you have essentially stolen this money. So just like Besdin will make you give back stolen money, it will do that here as well. Or maybe it's a ritual concept. But for some reason, Besdin is enforcing a ritual concept, which we sometimes find also. We have to figure out when we find it and when we don't find it, but sometimes Besdin gets involved in ritual matters as well. Or a third possibility, a hybrid possibility, is that it starts off with a ritual concept, but because it deals with money, it becomes a monetary debt inspired by a ritual obligation, and so Besdin is going to get involved because of that. So what difference does it make if I say one thing or I say the other thing? So just one difference, and then we'll probably stop here if we're out of time. One difference it would make is that there are different sets of rules that regulate things. So, for example, if we're talking about a ritual law, and we have a question whether I'm obligated or not. So if it's biblical law, so the rule is, you say, Safek d'oraisa v'chumra. Then if we're not sure how to apply Torah law, I have a Torah obligation, I'm not sure whether I'm obligated or not. So then we have to be stringent. We have to assume that you have to perform whatever obligation we're not sure about, or stay away from whatever prohibition we're not sure about. But when it comes to monetary law, where there's two parties, so how do you use that kind of terminology? So monetary law, we take a different standard. Then we assume that the presumption is 9/10 of the law, and that whoever, if we're not sure who wins, we're not sure where the obligation is, so then whoever is holding on to the money gets to keep it. That's the rule. The presumption wins. The presumption of possession is the deciding factor. So that's why we say that Safek Mamon, we leave with a Muchzak. If we're not sure about a monetary issue, we leave it with a person holding on to it. So that would lead us to an opposite conclusion. So, for example, if we have some question whether or not something is prohibited interest and whether or not I have to return it, so if we see it as a ritual concept, it'll be categorized as Safek D'oraisa L'chumra. I have to then assume I have to be stringent and pay it back. But if it's a monetary law, so then I'm not sure that I'm really obligated, so then, as the one who now has the money, because it was already collected, so then if it's unclear, the presumption goes on the person who's already holding on to it. So it leads you to the opposite conclusions. That's one of the reasons why it's important to clarify a little bit whether we're talking about a ritual obligation here or whether we're talking about a monetary obligation, which opens up a whole other can of worms. So maybe, God willing, next week, that's good. We'll look into some more of these concepts and then see how this plays out a little bit in the real world. Again, not to say that two sessions is going to cover all of the procedure, but to give us a little bit more of an exposure to some of the ideas that are involved. Okay, so we'll stop here. I'm willing to...